Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. When we talk about the senses, classically, we mention five, and they are sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. But certainly there are others that are very important. And this morning, in this part of the show, we'll talk about one of those, something that is certainly very vital to our basic daily functioning, but something that we don't think about very much because it happens at a level that we really don't notice. Balance is what we'll be talking about in this part of the show. It is a primary component in our everyday lives. It is something that is essential in almost every sport and as well as dance. But because it's rather complicated and operates at an unconscious level, we don't think about it very much. And in fact, it even escaped detection by scientists until the 19th century. We'll talk a little bit about the sense of balance this morning, how it worked, the role it played in our survival, maybe also why it took so long for science to discover just how it works. And our guest is Scott McCready. He is the author of a newly published book that is all about balance, and that's the title. The subtitle is In Search of the Lost Sense. It's published by Little Brown and is out now in bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. Our guest has written for a variety of publications, including Smithsonian, the Seattle Times, and Reader's Digest. He has twice won the Society of Professional Journalist Excellence in Journalism Award, and he's joining us this morning by phone. This is his first book. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us over the air or over the internet. 800-222-9455 is that number. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Mr. McCready, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you have written a lot about a number of different kinds of things, have done some science, things that we would call science writing, and also some other kinds of writing. So maybe it would not be real surprising that you would take up a subject like this. But let me just ask you in a direct way, what got you interested in investigating and writing about balance to the point where you have now done an entire book on the subject?
Well, I was a health reporter at the Seattle Times a number of years ago and began to investigate the epidemic of falling that's taking place across the U.S. and across the world, actually, and starting to put together some of the pieces. And my editor squelched the idea, didn't really want to pursue it at that point. So a couple of years later, I was hiking with my father on a trail near Seattle in the Cascades, and he took an uncharacteristic fall. He was 67 years old at the time and was standing on top of a boulder and was looking out over the valley and just standing there doing nothing unusual. And he had a backpack over his shoulder and proceeded to take it off on one side. And as it slipped over his shoulder, he followed the pack around and spun into a spiraling fall off the boulder. And I watched this happen from about 20 yards away and was just aghast at the injuries that he might be sustaining. So I ran over to him, and he was okay, sort of picked himself up and dusted himself off, and nothing was wrong with him. But as we hiked back down the trail, it just got me thinking about, you know, what is balance? What is the nature of balance, and how does it deteriorate as we age, and why isn't there more discussion about it? Why isn't it considered one of our prime senses? And is there anything that we can do to prevent it from deteriorating and to actually prevent falls from happening?
And at some point, I'm sure we'll be talking about that, because the answer to that question is yes. There are some things that can be done.
Yeah.
But I think, as you say, this is it's an important thing to study and to understand, because for older folks, falls are a serious problem and can lead to very serious injuries and problems that you can really go downhill from there. And apparently a good percentage, a healthy percentage, and I think it's something like 70% of falls are one way or another traceable to balance problems?
Well, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but a high percentage are. There are a lot of different risk factors for falling. Problems with balance is one of them. And you can have what's called a vestibular problem and a non-vestibular problem. The vestibular apparatus is one of the three sensory inputs for balance. It's a marvelous little organ that resides in your inner ear that measures your movement, the body's movement, as you move through space and all the different planes of space, as well as measuring gravity. And so in people who have dysfunction in their vestibular system, they can have balance problems. But there are other things, too. You can have a neurological problem. You can have a brain problem. You can have a heart problem. And those things, too, can lead to imbalance and to falling, perhaps. There's also problems with people that take medications. Sometimes their medications can cause imbalance. So there are a lot of different things. But what I focus on in the book are balance-related problems that people have and how balance deteriorates and what you can do to improve your balance.
Mm-hmm. And I think also you explain, and I so people should understand that it's actually the business of balance, of keeping us upright, is an interaction between several kinds of sources of information. The information we get from our muscles and our joints that say, tell us something. We get information from our eyes that tell us something. And then from this system in the ear that we get information from all three of these sources. And somehow our brain manages to put all that together to the end of keeping us from falling over.
That's right. It's a very complicated system. And it has evolved over millions of years, really. It's one of the oldest of the senses. It evolved right at the beginning of animal life. It was essential to our survival to know which way is up and which way is down, so that we can move through space. Also essential was to know where light was coming from. So we had primitive optic nerves that showed us where light was and where shadow was, so that we could, or primitive animals could, escape detection and escape the heat of the sun. There was also the touch sensor, which was another primitive sensor, which told us about temperature and where to seek an environment that was most conducive to our well-being. And then the vestibular sense, or the balance sense, was the third most ancient sense.
Hmm. Can you, and this is something that perhaps is difficult to do without being able to refer to a picture, but can you describe the vestibular mechanism, say at least a little bit of something about what it looks like and how it works?
Sure. There are two primary components of the vestibular apparatus. There's one behind, one located behind each ear, so we have two of them. And it's about the size of the end of your little finger. It's very small. A pencil eraser would be another analogy. And it consists of three sort of donut-shaped circles, and those are called the semicircular canals. And those are each oriented in one of the three different planes of space. Those detect movement in each of those planes. And that's rotational movement. And so as we're moving our heads, say, from side to side or up and down, the semicircular canals register that movement. And then there's another part of the vestibular system is the utricle and the saccule, they're called. And those are called otolith organs. And those measure lineal movement, movement in a straight line. Say if you were in a car and accelerating rapidly, those organs would monitor that acceleration. Or if you were in an elevator, going up in a building, those organs would measure that. And those are unusual in that they have these tiny calcium carbonate crystals in them. So the old adage that you've got rocks in your head is actually true. We all have rocks in our head, and those are what they are. And those are embedded in a gelatinous material with small hair cells next to them, so that when you're moving in a straight line, those little calcium carbonate crystals, because they have some weight and mass, will tend to lag behind, and then they stimulate these microscopic hair cells that then alert the brain that movement is taking place along that plane. So it's an amazing little organ, and we share its basic morphology or form with those of toadfish, which are, and many other fish actually, that are 300-400 million years old. So the basic shape and design of it hasn't changed over a long period of time, which indicates how efficient that design is.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Scott McCree. He's the author of the book Balance, In Search of the Lost Sense. It is published by Little Brown, and it is an explanation of the sense of balance, what it is, how it works, problems with balance, why that causes problems for us in our life, and also perhaps one of the things we'll talk about here is that things that you can do to try to ameliorate the decline in balance that everyone experiences, and once you get to be an adult, it seems that your sense of balance starts to degrade, but there are some things you can do about that, so we'll talk some more about that as we proceed here through this part of the show. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. We have somebody here who's ready to go in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just want to call and say I am so happy that somebody is naming this sense, because I have felt for decades that we had more than five senses and one of them is balance. And I mentioned this to a doctor not so long ago, and they said, oh, well, that's part of hearing. Well, part of the mechanism is in your ear, but it's not hearing. I mean, deaf people can still walk upright. So I just wanted to commend you on bringing it out.
Well, thank you. Actually, the vestibular sense is more ancient than the hearing sense in animals. It evolved first. So it actually sort of takes precedence over hearing in that way, at least in terms of survival. And the shape of it also is very similar to the cochlea, which is the hearing mechanism, which sits next to the vestibular system and is actually a part of it. So it is definitely a sense on its own. And I think if more people recognize that, that people would pay more attention to balance. It's because it does operate at a subconscious level. People tend to take it for granted, don't even think about their balance until they lose it, and then they obviously think about it in a big way. But even in the medical community, it's often not really recognized as something worth paying attention to. And if a problem does develop, some of them are so complicated and unfathomable that a series of doctors have to look at this problem in order for it to be solved.
It's interesting to ask this question, why is it that it took such a long time for medical science to understand how balance worked? Because we, no doubt human beings, have long understood that if it was not working, you had a problem. People have known about motion sickness, seasickness, for example, as you write in the book, forever. I mean, people
right.
have always known about that. They didn't know what caused it, but they knew that it existed.
Right.
Why was it that it wasn't until, I guess, sometime maybe in the 1800s that we really came to understand exactly, or at least, if not exactly, that we had a better idea about the mechanisms of balance?
Right. Well, it was Aristotle back almost 2,000 years ago who enumerated the five primary senses, and those are really the most obvious ones to detect, and I think that's why he listed those five. He wasn't able to sense some of the other ones with his own senses. and balance because it operates at an unconscious level, subconscious level, was one of them. In order to really understand how the balance system works, you have to be able to dissect the brain, actually, because the brain and the inner ear area are very close, and you have to be able to figure out what the vestibular system does. And for the longest time, because it was located next to the hearing part of the ear, it was considered to have something to do with the sense of hearing. And you also had to know what the function of the vestibular nuclei and the cerebellum are. Those are other parts of the brain into which the three sensory inputs for balance go. And that's where the brain sort of orchestrates those impulses and tells the rest of the body how to move in order to stay upright. So those things are really beyond the capacities, the scientific capacities of researchers at that time until about the 19th century when people began to figure out all the pieces of the puzzle.
Hmm. Well, we have another caller here. Let's talk with him in Casey. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm so glad to be tuning in just now for this. I think this book is actually overdue. It's a shame your editor didn't see fit to put it out. I think for many years in the healthcare system and in hospice, safety and falling are one of our biggest concerns. And I myself feel I have a balance problem. I noticed that in yoga, I can't stand on my right foot alone, or my left foot, I guess it is. And I've often wondered what I could do to improve my balance. And my mother can't lean, who's 85, can't lean backwards without going all the way back. So I think it's a critical and timely issue, and I just can't wait to get your book. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, maybe we should, there are a lot of things I'm sure that we could talk about here, but maybe we should just go right to the issue of, not put it off, go right to the issue of why, perhaps talk a little bit about why it is that with age beginning in adulthood, that individual sense of balance starts to degrade. And then perhaps we could go on and talk about those things that can be done to try to do what you can to preserve the sense of balance.
Okay. Well, the sense of balance peaks, apparently, when we're in our 20s, which makes sense when you consider that that's sort of the primary age for passing on our genes to the next generation. So for survival, that made sense. And then it tends to deteriorate in our 30s, slowly, and then begins to more rapidly decline in our 60s. And all three sensory inputs for balance degrade. Naturally, our sense of vision goes downhill. We all need to, or most of us need to get bifocals as we get older, so our eyesight becomes less crisp. The vestibular system also becomes less sensitive to movement, so it's not able to provide extremely accurate information to the brain. The hair cells in the vestibular system don't replenish themselves when they diminish or when they go away, and so that leads to less sensitivity there. And then the third system, which I haven't talked about yet, is proprioception, which are specialized cells in the muscles and joints, which communicate to the brain the positions of body parts in relation to itself. So that's the sobriety check that a lot of state police use when they have you stand and try to touch your nose with your fingertip with your eyes closed. That's the sense of proprioception. That's proprioception working there. Your brain knows where your finger is even without being able to see it because of those little cells that are in your arms and fingers. So all three of those things decline, especially after the age of 60. And then the other thing that begins to decline rapidly is muscle mass. After about the age of, I think it's 50 or 60, we lose between 10 and 15% of our muscle mass. per decade. And it's important for balance to have strong muscles, especially in the quadriceps, the thigh muscles, the torso, hips, so your stomach and back, as well as your ankles. Those all need to be kept strong in order to preserve your balance, in order to be able to respond to changes in your environment as you're walking along or moving in any sense. Hmm. So those are the primary elements.
So that sounds like then there are some things that perhaps we can't do very much about, but if you're interested in preserving and maintaining balance, then it sounds like one of the main things that you would suggest is that people continue to be physically active, have some sort of exercise, perhaps some weight-bearing exercise, and that by doing things like that, that sounds as if that would help, at least.
Oh, it definitely helps. Mm-hmm. You can, do things to improve and increase your muscle strength by doing, for instance, chair squats is a really good one, and lunges for improving your quadricep strength. One of the most important things also is to keep challenging your balance. Don't shut yourself up in your house and not go out and garden because you're afraid that you might fall or slip. The brain has to adapt to the diminished sensory inputs to balance, and in order to do that, it has to be challenged. It has to be exposed to those stimuli in order for it to adapt itself to it. The brain is very plastic, so it will make those adaptations, but it has to have the stimulus in order to do it. So even though sometimes it's an uncomfortable situation to be in, to place yourself in a precarious or unbalanced situation, the brain requires it in order to adapt. So there are ways that you can do that that don't require a lot of danger. You can, for instance, exercises to improve your balance. One of the best ones is simply to hang on to a chair and to stand on one leg and move the other leg out to the side or toward the back and hold it there for 10 seconds and just try to balance on that one leg as you're standing. And if you need the support of a chair, you can hang on to that so that you don't fall. But to do that a couple of times a day over a period of a couple of months, and you'll find that your balance is improving. They've actually done studies that show the benefit of that. Mm. There are lots of other things you can do as well. For instance, instead of walking on a sidewalk all the time, try walking across a park, which has undulating terrain, and maybe it's a little bit, maybe there are a few rocks in it, and it's a little more challenging to walk on, and that provides your brain a little more stimulation so that it can adapt to your changing sensory inputs.
We are at our midpoint here, and we have another call-up we'll get right to. I would just like to introduce once again our guest, Scott McCready. He is a writer. He's written for a number of publications, including Smithsonian Magazine. He is the author of a recently published book that explores balance, what it is, how it functions, why it's so important. Then the title of the book is Balance in Search of the Lost Sense, and it's published by Little Brown. So if you're interested in reading the book, go out to the bookstore and find it. Questions here are welcome too, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Chicago. This is line number 4.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I'd heard that the different parts of the body, the organs, the eye, ear, and so forth, do have a need for certain special nutrients. Recently, eye, for instance, needs vitamin C, ascorbic acid, in great quantity for its maintenance. And years ago, they commented the ear, nerves especially, require the most B vitamins of any other part of the body for its integrity and maintenance. And, of course, with smoking and pollution and other things that we're assimilating through our lungs and so forth, interfering with our nutrient balance and so forth, I thought I'd forward that information that these observers many years ago noted that B vitamins are really essential for the integrity of the ear nerves. Thank you.
All right. Well, is there anything that you feel can be said reliably about some connection between, particularly about diet, nutrition, and balance?
Well, I've read information about vitamin B12 and how when that is deficient in a human, that may lead to imbalance. And they're not really sure of the mechanism that's involved there, but it has something to do with the sheaths around nerves, and B12 is essential for that, so possibly it's interfering with the connection between the vestibular system or the proprioceptive system and the brain. That's a possibility there. I've heard that people with, for instance, Meniere's disease, which is a disease of the vestibular system in which there's a superabundance of pressure in the fluid in the inner ear, which sets off bouts of vertigo and nausea. People who have that disease are asked to refrain from eating a lot of salty foods. So there's something about salt that increases that pressure on the inner ear, which exacerbates the situation and makes it worse. But other than that, I don't really know of any other dietary requirements for good balance other than just a good balanced diet.
Mm. Well, we have a number of callers now we'd like to bring into the conversation. We'll do that, and we'll take them in the order that they came in. The first in line is in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. One thing you might mention, I'm sure you're aware of this, that there is a connection not between the semicircuit canal function and hearing, but rather in eye movement.
Yes.
Yeah, and if you spin very quickly, for example, you'll set up flicking movements to the eye. There are two other ways you can create that. One of them is squirting hot water in the ear or cold water, and the other is taking imbibing large amounts of alcohol will create the same kind of flicking of the eye.
Uh-huh.
But do you have any insights as to how figure skaters can do those pirouettes in the ice very quickly without setting up that nystagmic movement?
Right, right. Yes, that is sort of a mystery. Well, they do adapt to the movement to a certain extent.
Well, they can adapt to it then.
Through practicing and doing that, but they also have this little trick with their heads where their heads are not spinning at the same rate that their bodies are, and they tend to focus on one thing and then keep their focus there a little bit longer.
Yeah, I've seen ballet dancers do that where they'll spin their head around quickly and then let their body catch up underneath them.
Right, right.
But I've seen figure skaters that just don't do it. It's at least they don't seem to look like they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe their eyes are doing it and their head is moving, but I think there is something like that involved. Also whirling dervishes, people that just whirl for long, long periods of time without getting dizzy. I think what happens is that the brain adapts to that unusual movement after a while.
Yeah.
After years of doing it, they're able to do it without experience.
There's also a very quick comment. There's an illusion that is quite dramatic. If you spin in a barber chair, for example, and then at a steady rate, and then you tilt your head to one side,
mm-hmm.
You'll feel like you're climbing at the rate of 45 degrees.
Uh-huh.
Floyd Collins at the FAA Center was doing some research on this in Oklahoma City,
uh-huh.
And I actually saw this demonstrated, and it's quite dramatic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You sound like an otologist. Or...
No, I'm an experimental psychologist and sensory psychologist. So.
I see.
Right, I'm retired now.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was a very interesting program.
Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah,
well,
bye.
Just on that subject here, if the other folks wouldn't mind waiting for a second, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about motion sickness, since
mm-hmm.
that apparently is the most common balance problem, and probably an awful lot of people have experienced it. Some people have a lot of trouble riding in a car. Some people experience it when they fly, and a lot of folks, I'm sure, have experienced it on a boat. What really is going on here in motion sickness?
Well, in motion sickness, you've got a situation where there is a conflict between the sensory inputs for balance from the vestibular system, which is measuring movement, and vision. So when you're inside of a car, say a child is in the back reading or something, his vestibular system detects that there is motion going on. He feels bobbing up and down in the highway, or when he's when the car is turning, he feels that movement. But inside the cabin of the car, he's looking at his book, and the book isn't really moving. So his eyes tell him that there's no motion. So for some reason, and it's not really clear why this happens, that conflict between the two sensory inputs creates a feeling of nausea. This usually happens in childhood, between the ages of 1 and 20 is when it's most common. And it's felt that the reason that happens is because the brain hasn't really experienced many forms of unusual motion, so it hasn't developed internal models of those unusual motions to be able to reference to. So a child is just kind of developing a bank of experiences at that point, so this is particularly disturbing to him. As an adult, you don't tend to get motion sickness quite as much, depending on where you are and what you're doing.
A number of treatments have been advanced, and as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I think that, and as you talk about in this chapter, that people have known about seasickness forever,
right.
Certainly long before they knew what was going on, and mm-hmm. probably for as long as there has been seasickness, people have suggested cures or treatments, things. Is there anything that is really works reliably for helping people who have motion sickness problems?
Well, the transderm scop patches that you place behind your ear, those are pretty effective for most people. They deaden the impulses from the vestibular system to the brain so that you're not getting so many disturbing signals. And they also, some of those drugs tend to reduce the feeling of nausea that you would feel. The acupressure wristbands, some people swear by them. They think they're great, but the studies that have been done have been mixed. Some have shown that they work, and others have shown that they haven't. So that's not a particularly good way. So I think for people that are riding in a vehicle, the best things that you can do would be to look outside as you're moving, so that your vision is telling you that you're moving along with your vestibular system, so that there's no conflict between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons that drivers rarely get car sick, for instance. They're not only anticipating the movement of the vehicle, but their eyes are trained on the surroundings and are registering that movement of the car, so that it reduces or eliminates the sensory conflict.
Yeah. Well, just yesterday in the science section of the New York Times, there was an interesting article about some people who have the opposite problem. That is, for example, someone goes on a cruise, and very quickly they adjust to the movement, and they have no problem. They have a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they come home and they get on dry land again, they start to feel motion sickness.
Right.
And in some people, this can last for a very long time.
Yeah, that's a very disturbing disorder, and the people that have it are just devastated by it because they have these periodic bouts of vertigo and nausea when they're on dry land, but they were just fine on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Usually those people tend not to get seasick, for instance, if they're on an ocean liner, but they come on dry land and they have all kinds of vertigo problems. Now, scientists don't really understand exactly what's going on there, it's a very rare problem, but the people that have it are devastated by it.
Well, we get back here and talk to some more people who are on the phone. We'll go next to a caller in Charleston, line number 2.
Thank you. I was just wondering if there are other of our senses that seem to be so clearly dependent on gravity, as our sense of balance does. And something you just said reminded me of interdependence as well. I'd heard of people who are learning to fly instrument training in airplanes, and that as a part of that, they will have their eyes covered or face covered with a mask that makes it opaque, like they're blind in effect, and tell them to orient themselves so they feel that they're convenient and they're definitely flying horizontal. and then we'll flip the mask off, and they're headed right straight into the ground. Obviously something that the instructor does something about pretty quickly. And then in other senses, in other ways, that the senses are interdependent. It seemed to me I have read that, for example, the taste or sense of taste is affected by sight and the color of things that we eat. If you start feeding people not green eggs and ham, maybe that would do it too, but yellow or red or brown mashed potatoes or something, that your reaction to the food, both visually and the taste itself, actually changes. So go ahead. Thank you for being around.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, you can talk about any and all of that.
Well, I don't know of other senses that are dependent on gravity. I mean, the sense of the sensory input from proprioception is to a certain extent reliant on gravity, in that it senses the pressure that it feels under your feet. For instance, that's a very critical area for balance. Is the proprioceptive cells on the bottoms of your feet measuring the pressure that gravity applies to your body and is pushing you against the earth. When that becomes ambiguous, that signal, then you have more trouble with your balance. You have to rely on your other two inputs to make accurate measurements of your body position. But I don't know of other senses, as the caller asked, that rely on gravity for that.
Maybe you could say something about some of the difficulties that pilots do indeed face, because when you're flying a plane, it's very important to know which way is up, and if you don't, that can indeed cause the planes to crash.
Right. The vestibular senses is not very useful in the air, and in fact, it can lead to a number of different illusions that will fool a pilot and. If he's not careful, he can crash. John F. Kennedy Jr.'s crash over Martha's Vineyard in 1999 was the result of an illusion that occurred to his vestibular system, and I have a chapter in the book about exactly how that happened. But if you lose visual contact with the earth, you're in big trouble as a pilot unless you're instrument rated. And only about 20%, I believe, of pilots... recreational pilots are instrument rated. You have about 3 minutes from the time you lose visual contact with the earth before you begin what's called a graveyard spiral, which is just a twirling downward spiral into the earth. And that's because the vestibular system is registering motion in one direction. And it's actually the opposite of the way you're going, so that it's rather difficult to explain. Mm. But the vestibular system is giving you input, but it's false input. It's telling you that you're going the opposite direction of the way you're going, so you tend to make corrections that make the spiral worse.
So it's telling you that you're going up when, in fact, that you're going down. Or
right.
I suppose it could be the...
It's actually the rotational movement.
It's
telling you that you're going one direction when you're going the opposite direction.
Oh, okay.
And you make corrections that you think they're corrections just based on that input from your vestibular system, but it's actually making the situation worse, and you start to spiral faster. And it's a very big problem in the military, because... there's all kinds of spatial disorientation, they call it, that occurs with flying high-speed aircraft. And they are trying to devise all kinds of ways to help pilots to battle that.
Let's talk with a caller in Belgium, not too far away here, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You were just discussing, and some of your previous guests mentioned things that are essentially like what you do with a painting. You think you see something when actually it's not really there. Like trompe d'oeil, however you say the word. I'm not very good at my French. Now, does this sort of thing happen in space also? Because you've got a lot of problems that don't relate to Earth. You don't have gravity to help hold your ears in the direction, or these little things that are floating around in your ears.
Mm-hmm.
In a proper direction, you don't have the things in your muscles that are probably giving out the same signals. seems to me they would have a lot of quote-unquote seasickness, maybe you'd call it space sickness there, or you'd have a lot of problems with things being the way you'd want them to be.
Right, they do have a lot of problems with space sickness. That's that was one of the surprising things that I discovered in researching the book, is that many astronauts experience motion sickness in space. No matter how much training they've had on Earth, you could have some, you know, real macho jet fighter pilots. They go up in the space shuttle, and about a third of them get sick on their first flight. And it has to do with, as you say, the lack of gravity. It's not a weightless environment completely, but there's very little gravity. And those little calcium carbonate crystals in your ear, the ear rocks that we talked about, don't get a signal of gravity. So they're not able to register gravity. And so that's a very unusual perception for them. They've never experienced this before. So the internal models that your brain has provided for you living on Earth are no longer relevant. They're no longer useful. And there's a conflict between what the otolith, the ear rock organ, is telling you and what those internal models that you have in your brain are telling you. So you've got this sensory conflict set up, which causes nausea and in some cases vertigo. And that can be a major problem in space, because in microgravity it becomes a big deal if you throw up. That can create quite a mess. And if you're in a space suit, for instance, and outside the craft, and you get sick, this can be a life-threatening situation. So it's something that space scientists take very seriously and are doing a lot of research on.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Urbana for another call here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hi. I bought a set of those wrist. I forget what you called them. They're wrist elastics that have a little bump in them that you put on to help prevent nausea. I just carry them in case I'm traveling on an airplane and we hit extended turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get severe car sickness, so it seems to help, but I haven't tried it that often. But they're not very big, and they're not very expensive. And I thought Consumer Reports said that they'd been tested and that they seemed to work. But I wanted to comment on what I had just recently read about Dramamine. There's a new book out on memory loss by Catherine Rahman, and she talks about medications, among other things, that can cause memory loss problems. And I think she mentions Dramamine as being one of them. I'm not sure about the patch that you talk about. So it's something to keep in mind, that one might have temporary memory problems from something like that. And I thinking about the balance thing, I was listening on NPR one evening, I think it was a Saturday evening, and they were talking about, it was the People's Pharmacy, and somebody called in and said that they had vertigo from using glucosamine chondroitin. And I'd been taking some to protect my knees, and I was thinking, you know, I've been bothered recently by having to think about my balance in an unusual way. So I stopped taking it, and the problem went away. Have you ever seen anything about glucosamine?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard that glucosamine causes imbalance. I know that there are certain antibiotics that are used in a hospital setting that cause problems with the vestibular system. One of the most common ones is called gentamicin, and that's it's an ototoxic drug, which means that it will severely affect your hearing and balance. At least in some people, the prevalence of that is something like 5 to 40% of the people who take or are given gentamicin have this ototoxic effect. And I've spoken with people who have had their vestibular systems severely damaged after stays in the hospital when they have been given a regime of this antibiotic.
Ooh, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's something to watch out for. You might request another kind of antibiotic. Gentamicin is one of the most common, and it is extremely bad for your ears. So something to discuss with your doctor anyway.
And a separate question, there was, I think it was Prodigal Summer by Barbara Kingsolver, reading a while ago, and she at one point talks about a character who helps another one who has vertigo, and I forget what circumstances he did, and she does something about positioning his head to get the otolith to move around in a
right, right.
Is that a standard procedure, and what does it help? When does it help somebody?
Well, it's used for a malady called positional vertigo, or top shelf vertigo is another name for it. And what happens is that when people move their head in a certain direction, they can cause nausea or vertigo in the inner ear. And what's happening is that the ear rocks that we talked about, that I talked about earlier, get repositioned. They stray out of the place where they're supposed to be and into the semicircular canal, where they can stimulate the hair cells there and falsely indicate that there's motion going on. So you'll feel this sense of vertigo, which is spinning, even though you're not spinning, and that can cause nausea and all kinds of problems. It's also called top shelf vertigo because, you know, this is one of the positions that people get their heads into. They'll be looking for something on the top shelf in the kitchen, and all of a sudden they'll feel nauseous and vertigo. So what this maneuver that Barbara Kingsolver refers to does is it repositions that errant piece of calcium carbonate back to where it's supposed to go. And it's a simple yet very complex series of motions that a trained person will move the patient in to reposition those out of the semicircular canal and back into the utricle or saccule where it belongs. And this procedure was developed by a Portland vestibular doctor. His name is John Epley, Portland, Oregon, and about 15 years ago. And when he first came up with this idea, he was laughed at by most of the medical community. They thought there was no way that something this simple could work. But he kept at it with his own patients, and some studies were done that showed that it was effective. And it's effective in something like 90% of the patients that he does it on. And now it has become standard procedure throughout the world. It's called the Epley maneuver. And it's a highly effective treatment for this positional vertigo, which is a very common vertigo amongst older people. It's about half the causes of dizziness in the over 60 set are caused by positional vertigo. So most doctors will look at you as if you're crazy when you go in and tell them about it. It oftentimes takes seeing five doctors and up to 10 years of suffering from this common vertigo before someone figures out that, oh, this is positional vertigo. You go to a specialist, and in 10 minutes you're cured. So it's one of those miraculous sorts of remedies.
So what sort of specialist would you see if you know somebody who has this problem?
Well, there are physical therapists who specialize in vestibular rehabilitation. Most of them would know how to do this, as would any otologist or neuro-otologist, or people that deal with ear problems, ear, nose, and throat doctors. Many of them have been trained. It's a very simple maneuver. It doesn't take a lot of time to learn it as a doctor or a therapist, but not that many people practice it. So you would have to call around and find out who knows how to do the Epley maneuver. But, you know, of course, you have to be diagnosed first with this specific type of vertigo called positional vertigo.
Cool. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Thank you. We're coming down to the point here where we maybe have a minute or two left. I mentioned way back at the beginning of the program that certainly while balance is important to everyone, there are certain kinds of occupations or activities, particularly sports and dance, and I guess also being a pilot, where having these things work well are extremely important. Is it the case that there are some people, though, who are somehow simply born with a better sense of balance, or does that have something to do with early practice I'm thinking about the famous story about the who is it was one of the Walendas that you talk about in the book,
mm-hmm.
Who was a wire walker, and you'd have to think, well, if you got to have a pretty good sense of balance to be able to do that, or perhaps I'll be a gymnast and work on the balance beam and so forth. Are there some people who just innately have a better sense of balance than average?
I think that there probably is a continuum. Some people have better balance than others innately, but I think most of it is through training. The story that you're talking about is the one about Carl Walenda when he was young, and his family was a family of circus acrobats, and they got him on a low wire very early in his childhood, and he learned how to walk on a low wire and then gradually learned how to walk on a high wire, and that's how most of these circus acrobats learn, as they go in as children and then are drilled in the various balance activities that they're going to do for hours and hours. And I think that through that diligent regimen of training, their balance sense develops to a higher degree than most people. But I think that most people could do the same thing if they were exposed to the same thing. So it's the other interesting element of that is that by practicing throughout their lives, these people like Harold Davis, another wire walker, and Carl Walenda were able to maintain their really good sense of balance into their old age. I mean, many wire walkers live until they're in their 70s and 80s and die of natural causes. So they actually walk on a wire frequently through their middle age period and as older people too,
mm-hmm.
and maintain that superb sense of balance that they've developed in childhood.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. We're here at the end of the time. For folks who want to read more on the subject, you look for the book Balance in Search of the Lost Sense, published by Little Brown, by our guest Scott McCready. And Scott, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me on.